We're doing in Yaakov. We're up to the sixth chapter of Shabbos, Bame Isha Yotzah. The topic of the chapter is within the prohibition of carrying in public domain, carrying from private to public domain. So within that prohibition, the sages also prohibited a woman to go around with jewelry that she might come to show off to her friends, because our sages were concerned she'll be standing in the public domain and I'll tell her friends, look what my husband got me. And she'll take off this piece of jewelry and show it to her friends. And then she'll end up walking around with it, carrying it in the public domain, which is a biblical prohibition. So the chapter focuses on which jewelry may a woman wear in public domain on Shabbat and which not. Now, it's interesting that Rashi points out already in the chapter that the women don't listen. He says, you know, we have a discussion of what they should and shouldn't do. And he says, well, some of the stuff they shouldn't do, they don't listen to us. And, well, we're not going to make a big fight out of it. And that's also what's written in Shulchan Aruch, that parts of these halachot, the women just wouldn't listen, so we don't make a fuss over it. Basically, the theme is those ornaments which she won't take off in public domain, either because it's beneath her dignity to take them off in public domain, or else because she'd have to reveal parts of herself that she doesn't want to reveal, like take off her head covering or something, take off a band that holds her head covering. So those pieces of jewelry were less concerned that she'll come to take them off. The women that were in Persia used to drape a big cloth around themselves, and then they'd have this stone or coin that they'd wrap the loop around. Well, even if that's a very fancy coin, she ain't going to take off that coin because her whole garment could unveil, right? Could unravel. So she's not about to do that. So there are different ornaments, which the sages said, we're not really concerned she'll go showing them off in public domain. So those she can wear in public domain. So that's the subject of the chapter. With that introduction, we begin. The Mishnah says, "V'lo be'ir shel zahav." A woman should not go out into public domain with a gold city. "Mai be'ir shel zahav." So the Talmud asks, "What's this gold city?" Rabba Barbachan Amar Rabbi Yochanan. We have a quote in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Yerushalayim de dahava. It's an ornament that was called Yerushalayim shel zahav, Jerusalem of gold. Kad avid le Rabbi Akiva le debitu. Like Rabbi Akiva made for his wife. Rabbi Akiva initially married and then lost his first wife and had a child from her named Yoshua. Later on, he became known as Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcho. They had to hide him from the Romans, so they couldn't call him Rabbi Yoshua ben Akiva. So they called him Rabbi Yoshua, son of the bald one. Rabbi Akiva was famous for his bald spot. That's Rabbi Yoshua. And then Rabbi Akiva worked as a shepherd for Kalba Savua, one of the great philanthropists at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. And his daughter, who was super educated, Rachel, held Rabbi Akiva in very high regard. And so, Rachel. And she wanted to marry him, and her father opposed. Father said, the guy doesn't know a single pasuk in all of the Torah. You say, Shema Yisrael, he doesn't know how to finish the pasuk. You come from the best family, why would you marry him? Rabbi Akiva was tremendously humble, and she saw the great potential in Rabbi Akiva, so she went against her father's wishes, and she married Rabbi Akiva, and when she married him, he didn't even know the Aleph Beis. He didn't know how to read, he was so illiterate, he didn't know the Aleph Beis. And she believed he would have a future, so she took him and his son, Yoshua, and she married him. It was his second marriage. When her father heard it, her father took a vow she'd have no benefit from any of his wealth, and so they lived in dire poverty. And it says that they lived in a shack with hay, and he would take the hay out of her hair. In the morning, when they'd get up, she'd have hay in her hair, and he'd take it out of her hair, and he promised her at one point, he said, if I had money, I would get you a Jerusalem of gold, meaning I'd get you that beautiful crown. Women used to wear half a crown, which would have Jerusalem engraved on it. And he told her, if only I could, that's what I would do. And here we have many different concepts we learn. Number one, ever since the destruction of the temple, Kala is not allowed to go out with a gold crown. So just as we were discussing here, that crown that Rabbi Akiva promised his wife, that was so long as the temple was up. One of the institutions, ever since the temple was destroyed, is that women do not come to their wedding with a gold or silver crown. Well, today all the crowns are fakes. That's okay. You know, Kalas will sometimes wear those little crowns, and that's okay because none of it's real. So that's one aspect of the Jerusalem of gold. But we also learn from Rabbi Akiva that sometimes it's important to make promises. Giving your wife the feeling, if I could, I would, is a tremendous feeling. And she knew he meant it, because when he could afford it, he became wealthy from a few different things, the Talmud tells us. And later on, when he became wealthy, he inherited his father-in-law's wealth. And he once had a Roman woman who he took a loan from, and then she asked him, who's going to co-sign your loan? And he said, well, God, through this river. She said, okay, the river and you are responsible for the loan. And the time came to pay back the loan, and he couldn't show up. He was held up. And she said, but I need the money. She went to the river and she said, God, I trusted you. I trusted your Rabbi Akiva. I know if he could make it, he would be here. But he's not here. So I gave the river the responsibility of paying me back. And as she's saying that, a chest sweeps up onto the shores by her feet. And she opens it up and she sees some lost treasure that was swept onto the shores. And she takes it, and when Rabbi Akiva comes to pay the debt, she says, no, I went to the cosigner, I got my debt back. And the Roman woman wouldn't accept the money back. She said, here's the gift to you, Rabbi Akiva. And she made Rabbi Akiva wealthy too. So there are three sources of Rabbi Akiva's wealth. At any rate, when he became wealthy, he did buy her that jewelry. He didn't just say, if I could, I would. When he could, he did. So the Mishnah says, a woman could not go out into the public domain with that piece of jewelry. We do suspect that she'll take it off and say, look what my hubby got me. And so so the halacha says, that's the Gemara says, what is this Jerusalem of gold? That's what it is, like Rabbi Akiva made his wife. Yes, Yaakov, you want to say something?
I wanted, at this point, before he starts living together with this daughter, it's a very esteemed daughter, he's already done cure. How did he manage to
He wasn't a ger. His parents were gerim. His parents, it says Rabbi Akiva was ben gerim.
People said so many times that he could cure himself. So maybe I misunderstood.
I don't know why they said that. The Talmud in Tractate Bracho says that he was ben gerim. Okay. Okay. She sent him to yeshiva to learn for a long time. Unculus was a convert, right?
But I thought Akiva was also.
No, as far as I know, what it says is Rabbi Akiva is a descendant of Gera.
Answers a lot of questions.
Okay. He's called Akiva ben Yosef. Saying. Yeah.
Rachel must have done a lot of educating of Yeshua, because he got too old, and it's mainly during those formative years. It's a lot harder to change a person once he's out of, he gets older and that. So she must have been also educating the son, I would assume.
They both went to yeshiva. It says they both went to yeshiva and learned Aleph Beis. She sent them both together. They both went to yeshiva. They both sit in kindergarten together, learning Aleph Beis.
Okay.
Yeah.
What were his qualities since that she chose him?
Rabbi Akiva was humble. His quality was that he had tremendous humility. That was his great quality. Like Moshe Rabbeinu, right? He had good midot. I'm saying a person who has humility has the other midot that build up to humility. The next story in the Gemara, in order to understand it, we have to see the background in Tractate Kesubos. Background to the story. Okay, so background to the background is that Rebbe once wanted to know one form of bowing. They used to bow in the temple, and there were different forms of bowing, bowing to your knee, and then there was bowing from the waist all the way down. You bend down, like straight down. And one of Rebbe's disciples, his name was Levi, and he wanted to show Rebbe one form of bowing called Keda. So he did. He showed Rebbe. And as he showed Rebbe, he hurt his back, and he became a cripple from that day onward. Later on, he got cured. But he was known as the one with the limp. Because he got crippled from showing that form of bowing. So, second. We have the following story. The Gemara describes that. Okay, we'll start from the beginning. It's a very interesting story. It says like this. When Rebbe was lying on his deathbed, he said, I want my children here. So his children were brought in, his sons. And he said to them, be careful to honor your mother. Make sure that just as when I was alive, I'd have a candle lit at the table. You should always have that candle lit. The table should always be set. The bed should always be made. Yosef, Chofni, Shimon, they are important people. Ephrati, they were the ones who took care of me when I was alive. They should take care of me when I pass away. They should carry the bed. So the Gemara asks, why did he have to tell his children, honor your mother? It's a biblical commandment. So the Gemara answers, because it was a second marriage. Rebbe's first wife passed away. He married a second woman, and she wasn't their mother. So long as he's alive, they have to honor her as his wife. But once he's dead, they don't. So he said, please honor her. Why did he say, prepare all these things? So the Talmud says a scary line. It says every Friday he'd come back home. He was dead, but every Friday he'd come back home. It says that when word got out, he stopped coming. He didn't want people to say, oh, this one was pious enough that his spirit comes to visit his family on Friday nights, and this one wasn't. He didn't want people to go talking, so he stopped going. He continued, he said, don't eulogize me in the big cities. And after 30 days, get the yeshiva learning all over again. Don't let people be distracted too long. My son Shimon, he is the Chacham. My son Gamliel, he is the future Nasi. And Chanina Bar Chama, he should be the Rosh Yeshiva. Okay, so he left clear orders who should take over when he passes away. So the Talmud says that when Rebbe passed away, they came to Rebbe Chanina Bar Chama, and they said, Rebbe left clear orders, you should be the Rosh Yeshiva. Rebbe Chanina Bar Chama said, I don't accept. They said, but Rebbe said. He said, right, but there's a rabbi here who's 2.5 years older than me, and I'm not going to step on his toes. Appoint him the Rosh Yeshiva. The rabbi's name was Rebbe Ephes. So even though Ephes, yeah, in modern Hebrew, Ephes is Hebrew, right? Ephes is zero. So they listened to him. He said, I'm not accepting. You have to appoint Rabbi Ephes as Rosh Yeshiva. So they appointed Rabbi Ephes as Rabbi Yeshiva. Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama said, I don't have to sit like one of the students in front of Rabbi Ephes. I was supposed to be the Rosh Yeshiva. On the one hand, he showed him the respect of being Rosh Yeshiva. On the other hand, he sat outside the Beis Medrash and learned his own thing. And Levi went to sit next to him. Levi was that student of Rebbe who showed him how to bow and then got wounded. So Levi said, it's not right. Rebbe Chanina Bar Chama, he's the big rabbi here. He's sitting all alone outside. I'll sit with him. I'll keep him company. So he learned with him. So then, when Rebbe Ephes passed away, so Rebbe Chanina became the Rosh Yeshiva. Levi thought to himself, he said, what am I doing? Now I got nothing to do out here. To go in and listen to the shiur, I guess he was so big. He wasn't up to par. The shiur wasn't big enough for him. So he went out to Babylon. And that's where our Gemara begins, that Rav was chief rabbi in Babylon. And they told him, a great rabbi came from the city of Narda from Israel, and he is a cripple. He has a limp. So that's what they came and told Rav out in Babylon. So Rav started surmising. They told Rav, that's where our Gemara begins. Amru le Rav, they told Rav, Ata gavra rabba richa le Narda, a tall, important person came to Babylon, umatla, and he has a limp, Vidarash, and he taught Kalila Shari, that a woman is allowed to go outside in public domain with the ornament called a Kalila. Amar, so Rav said, now who was Rav? Do we know who Rav was? Okay. Rav, what was Rav's real name? Rabbi Abba. Rav was the nephew of Rabbi Chiya. Who was Rabbi Chiya? Rabbi Chiya was Rabbi's contemporary. So at the same time that Rabbi was Rosh Yeshiva, was the Nasi, when Rabbi was the Nasi, there was a question, who should be Nasi? Rabbi Chiya or Rabbi? Because they were both, there's a question in the Talmud, we skipped that over here in Ksubos, the Talmud asks, who was bigger, Rabbi or Rabbi Chiya? We generally assume that Rabbi Chiya learned his wisdom from Rabbi. But nonetheless, the Talmud leaves it hanging. Okay, here we got to do a little bit of Hasidut. Guys, what did the Baal Shem Tov used to do? What? He taught children, right? The Baal Shem Tov taught children. So, how important is it to teach children? Isn't it more important to be the head of the Jewish people? So it says that when they had to choose who would be the leader of the Jewish people, they thought to appoint Rabbi Chiya. And they said, no, Rabbi Chiya is educating the children of the generation. He keeps teaching. He goes to one city and he educates the kids, and then he goes to the next city and he educates the kids. So, G'dolim Ma'aseh Chiya. So Rabbi Feinstein, in his introduction to his responsa, he discusses this concept that ordinarily we think to be the chief rabbi, that's the biggest deal. And he says, you see from here that it's a very, very big deal to be an educator. And when I taught my first class, I taught a youth group in shul, Rabbi Tendler's shul. Rabbi Tendler's Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law. So before I started teaching, I asked him, Rabbi, what can you tell me? What do I need to know? So he told me two tips. He said, number one, his father-in-law, Rabbi Feinstein, used to say that people think that to educate kids, you could take the average Joe. No, the one who educates kids should also be very learned. Because you see, Rabbi Chiya was fit to be the leader of the Jewish people. So what do you need him to teach the kids for? Take someone less than him to teach the kids. Why does he have to teach the kids? So from here, Rabbi Feinstein understood that you need big people to teach children. Don't assume that the one who teaches the little children doesn't have to know too much. The more he knows, the better it is for the kids. Even those that educate little kids should be as big as possible. That's one thing he told me. And number two, he told me, he said, don't quote something you don't look up. Any medrash you want to tell them, any story, look it up. Look it up before you quote it. So those were the two tips he gave me. So coming back to here. So Rav was Rabbi Chiya's nephew. Rav was studying under Rebbe. Remember, Rav and Shmuel are the first generations of Amoraim. Shmuel, we discussed last week, he was Rebbe's doctor. He was the astronomer. Shmuel and Rav were contemporaries. Rav became chief rabbi out in Babylon. Now, when he left Israel for Babylon, his uncle, Rabbi Chiya, went to Rebbe and said, I need smicha for my nephew. He's going out to Babylon. You got to give him smicha. So Rav got a form of smicha, went out to Babylon and taught. And when Rav was in Babylon, he gets word, people tell him, a big rabbi came, and he's got a limp, and he taught out here in Babylon that women could go out with this ornament called Kalila. So he said, who's that guy with a limp? That must be Levi. Everyone knew Levi was the one. Shma mina nach nafshei de Rabbi Ephes. He said, okay, so then I could surmise Rabbi Ephes must have passed away. And then Rabbi Chanina became Rosh Yeshiva. And then Levi said, what am I going to do out here? So he left, he came here. So the Talmud says, maybe Rabbi Chanina passed away, maybe Rabbi Ephes remained the head of the yeshiva. So he says, no. If Rabbi Ephes would have still been around, Levi would have gone in to listen to him. The only reason he sat outside was to keep Rabbi Chanina company. If Rabbi Hanina, but if Rabbi Ephes passed away and Rabbi Hanina became the Rashiva, then he had no reason to stick around. This teaches us a very important concept. We've discussed it many times, and here we see an example of it. The rabbis knew very accurately what each rabbi's level was. One of the tools to acquiring Torah, the Mishnah at the end of Tractate Avos says, there are memchet, 48 attributes you need to acquire in order to succeed in acquiring Torah. One of them is yodea et mikomot, to know one's place. To know one's place, to know where am I. You know, when they would sit in yeshiva, they would sit in rows, and you defined where you belonged. The rows went according to your level. And every student knew where he belonged. He knew which students were bigger than him. He knew which students were smaller than him. And part of acquiring Torah is knowing that. It's something to work on. Very often we get confused. And we feel like we know a lot when we don't really know a lot. We feel like we don't know a lot when we already do know a lot. Talmud says it's not an easy thing. It's just like acquiring any other trait. But the rabbis of the Talmud did know. It was very clear to Rav which rabbi was bigger than Levi and which rabbi was not bigger than Levi. And it wasn't about ego. Sometimes we see these discussions. Rabbi Hanina doesn't go inside to hear the class. So that sounds like an ego. Why aren't you going inside? The answer is because there's halachic weight. If I sit in front of him when he's teaching a class and I'm indicating to all the students I need to hear his teachings, so then when I will conflict with him, they will give him the greater halachic weight. They'll say, he's the teacher, I'm the student. There was a system here, and the moves they made were, they stemmed from a distilled, pure desire to attain the truth, but also from a pure understanding of where each person was. So by the same token that Rabbi Hanina insisted appoint Rabbi Ephes as Rosh Yeshiva, at the same time, he didn't say, therefore, I'm going to sit inside, I'm one notch lower. That's the beautiful balance here. He's the one that put him at the top. And he's also the one who said, but I don't belong sitting there with the students. There isn't a big enough par between us. I don't own that. And not only I don't own that, I'm not going to give that indication that he has a greater halachic weight, because he doesn't. And Rabbi Ephes knew that, and Rabbi Hanina knew that, and Levi knew that. Everyone knew that.
But then wouldn't they have to give some other considerations? Because we wouldn't normally just give a couple of years age over wisdom to appoint the
right
top. Others.
I don't know. I also don't know why Rabbi Hanina vetoed Rebbe's what Rebbe asked. You know, Rebbe left behind a will and testament, and Rabbi Hanina vetoed it. And I'll tell you another question on this whole story. We learned in Tractate Brachos that at one point Shmuel, before he passed away, was revealed what was going on in the other world. And one of the things he saw is that Levi wasn't allowed into the academy in heaven. They said, all the years you sat outside when Rabbi Ephes was teaching, you're going to wait outside. You're not allowed to join all the other rabbis in heaven. Wait a second, but Levi, seems like Levi did what was right. The Talmud says, no, Levi was punished for what he did in heaven. When he got to heaven, they said, you sat outside when Rabbi Ephes was teaching. That wasn't a nice thing to do. But Levi had a good calculation, right? The Talmud seems to back his calculation. So why was he punished? I don't know. The Talmud says Shmuel was told, we value you in heaven. So Shmuel said, well, if I'm of any value, then let Levi into let Levi in. And they listened to him. They let him in. So the Talmud tells us all of that. What does any of that mean, right? So I don't know. I don't know. I'm saying those are the two sides of the coin here. Yeah, Yaakov, you wanted something? Okay. So I'll tell you a few stories. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach wanted to publicize a response in which he argued on Rav Moshe Feinstein. So he sent his response to Rabbi Feinstein and asked him, am I allowed to publish this? Because it was obvious then that Rabbi Feinstein was bigger than him. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, wrote a responsa about brain death and what constitutes death in halacha. And when he finished writing the responsa, he flew into Israel and showed it to Rav Eliashiv and asked him if it's okay that he publicizes it, if Rav Eliashiv agrees with him. So this idea, with big people, this idea still exists. The big people, again, big people. Little people get this point confused. Big people understand that they're bigger than them, that there are people that are bigger than them, and there is such a system where people say, I'm not going to argue. I could tell you that there were questions that Rav Nevinzel was asked, and he gave a certain ruling, and then he was told, you know, Rav Eliashiv said differently. So he said, don't publish what I said. If he said differently, his ruling is what goes. He's the Gadol HaDor. I'm talking about a story from 10, 15 years ago. So yes, among big people, the concept still exists.
Why doesn't it work for the small people? It's harder. You illustrated that point before. It was so beautiful when you said both Moshe Rabbeinu, big person, grew up in the palace, this aristocrat. Everybody was humble. And Rabbi Akiva, at that time, was a little shepherd. The obvious question, what's he have to be arrogant about? But the beauty of that story is people find something to be arrogant about. Little, big, it's a fantastic thing if you're humble no matter what. That's powerful, you know?
It's that idea the Talmud says about David HaMelech also. It says, Michtam. Why say Michtam? It says that David was a whole, both when he was mach, when he was downtrodden, but also when he became great, he had the same humility. The same humility, yeah. So, you see, it takes work. You see, it's one of the 48 attributes one needs to acquire in order to be able to acquire Torah.
Could it also be because of something else which we haven't mentioned so far, which is that maybe because it was a lot more full-time life study and learning in earlier generations, maybe, less preoccupied with worldly matters, that everyone kind of heard each other arguing in the Beit Midrash, and now and then the greats, everyone would know what they were in the Beit Midrash, and people would listen, and it would be a lot more clear who had the upper hand in the arguments or the rationale, or not so much.
I hear. I don't know. I never thought of it. I hear. I don't know. It's a good point. I don't know. Okay. You're sure.